Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our second panel, Assessing Strategies for De-Radicalization. My name is Chaim Malka. I'm the Deputy Director of the Middle East Program here at CSIS. It's a pleasure to see so many of you here today interested in North Africa and the issues that we're looking at this conference. One of the reasons one of the many reasons why I'm so fascinated by North Africa is it really is a region that shares many common traits, many common characteristics, faces many of the same challenges, and yet each country is so unique. It has its own context, it has its own political culture, its own form of government, and it faces its own unique forms of extremism and terrorism. And I think that uniqueness in each of the four countries of the Maghreb, or five, depending on how we count. At CSIS, we count it a little different, usually. But it's that uniqueness which I think is so fascinating and what makes the states of the region so interesting. Each government is taking its own unique approach to fighting radicalization and de-radicalization in North Africa. We've seen the amnesty plans that were mentioned earlier, co-optation of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, and other governments that are trying to promote re-education and trying to promote more indigenous and traditional forms of Islam and a more tolerant version of Islam. So what we're trying to examine in this panel, what we want to look at, is really the different strategies that each government is taking to approaching the fight against extremism, how effective those strategies have been, how might those strategies be evolving, and what lessons might be applied across the region and even beyond the region. So to help us make sense of these complex issues, we're very fortunate to have with us really an exceptional panel of people who are intimately familiar with North Africa, who have on-the-ground experience, and who bring very different experiences and perspectives to this discussion. So I think we're extremely fortunate to have them all today. We'll start with Ambassador Vicky Huddleston, who is Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Africa. Ambassador Huddleston was appointed to her position in June of 2009. She's had a distinguished career in the U.S. government. She is a four-time Chief of United States Missions in Latin America and Africa. She has also served in places where they rarely see snow. She was ambassador to Mali and to Madagascar. She's also served as the deputy chief of mission in Haiti. She holds an MA from the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and she was recently in the Maghreb working with our partners there, and from what I understand, has spent a lot of energy in the last few months working with regional governments and trying to strengthen their capacity in fighting terror. So, Ambassador Huddleston, we're delighted that you're with us. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. And I want to say it's an honor and a pleasure to be here. And the first panel was so fascinating and interesting to me that I have to tell you that I will wind my way back to it, because indeed it's the area and the topic that I feel that I know the most about. I have to admit that I feel as if I'm not an expert in any way on this issue of de-radicalization, and really am here because I feel that it is indeed such an important issue. However, on that note, let me begin, and I'll make a few observations about this topic. And perhaps the best way to begin is to quote President Obama, who is always very eloquent and to the point. All of us must decide whether we are serious about peace or whether we only lend it lip service. Getting to peace, of course, is not simple. It is not a matter of just destroying the enemy or ensuring that governments can provide stability and opportunity. Getting to peace means using all the instruments of government. The governments impacted must react and do what is right and good and needed, and the international community, its organizations and institutions, as well as their allies, must assist in that effort. Because indeed, as we've already heard this morning, terrorism of any kind affects not just one state, but whole regions, and indeed regions in Africa have a direct impact upon what is happening in France and Spain and indeed in the United States. When we look at the countries of North Africa and how they've responded, we heard in some detail from Ambassador Sanderson, who is indeed the expert on it. And I'm just going to touch upon this lightly because I'd just like to emphasize that when I hear her speaking and when indeed I think about this issue, I realize that it's not a matter of one approach. It's a matter of, as we like to say now in Washington, the whole of government approach. And that's what indeed you have to have to approach the issue of terrorism. But it is also, I think, just taking a superficial look at this, it is also the nature of the terrorism that each country faces. When we look at North Africa, immediately we think about, when we think about terrorism in North Africa, we think about Algeria. Why? Because Algeria has lost by far the most number of civilians in its battle against terrorism. And because terrorism was at one time widespread in Algeria, Algeria, in fact, had recourse more to military, police, and law enforcement methods because it had to immediately address an existential threat to the state. Algeria has also used other methods, as Ambassador Sanderson indicated, amnesty and reconciliation. But I think that might just put up there, it depends on how deep that threat is. Tunisia, on the other hand, has faced a much less severe problem, and Tunisia has been able to more effectively, perhaps, prevent the spread and the growth of terrorism by prohibiting the formation of religious-based political parties, as well as addressing economic and social issues. In other words, perhaps getting to some of the roots and the basis of the problem before it becomes a type of problem that it became in Algeria, in which you essentially have something that it comes close to a civil war. Libya, too, has had some success because it was able to persuade the LIFG away from violence. Again, a successful manner of approaching the problem. Morocco, I would say, has had the most comprehensive approach to terrorism. And it has relied, as I mentioned, on our whole of government or our combination of security and security measures such as and reform measures. It has regulated preaching. It has addressed directly terrorists who have gone into countries in Europe, and it has taken on social reforms such as prison reforms, education, and outreach. So it doesn't appear to me that there is a right or a wrong strategy. Rather, it is a need for a comprehensive strategy and very definitely a need for cooperation and interaction among the states within the region and their allies outside the region. This brings me to what the United States is doing, and most specifically what AFRICOM and the Department of Defense might be doing in the area. And I would like to mention two programs, and one, of course, is our Operation Active Endeavor, which is a naval operation of our NATO members and in our North African allies in the Mediterranean Sea to prevent the movement of terrorists and weapons of mass destruction. And this facilitates the security of shipping, and it also contains the problem of terrorists moving up into Europe and outside of North Africa. The other most notable program, and this will bring me back to the area with which I am most familiar, is the Trans-Saharan Counterterrorism Program. And again, this is a State Department, a USAID, and a DOD program. The part of it which is a DOD program is the Operation Enduring Freedom Trans-Sahara. And that is where AFRICOM, is training and equipping Malian security forces, Mauritanian security forces, and assisting Chad and Burkina Faso to a lesser degree in the area so that they have more ability to confront the AQIM in the area. The State Department and AID, for their part, are addressing these issues on development, on education, and on reconciliation. I think what we need to have, in particular, to address the AQIM threat is a very strong commitment to all of these factors that lead into terrorism. And that's why I thought that the question that John raised was so very, very interesting. Is it still, if I can paraphrase a little bit, a matter of ideology? Because when we get to Africa, I wonder, is it still a matter of ideology? Professor Filou said that he felt that there was a considerable prejudice within the Al-Qaeda movement. And I would certainly not disagree with him. But I think what we're beginning to see in Africa, and in particular in sub-Saharan Africa, is that Africans increasingly are willing to become the foot soldiers in this terrorist movement. And I think that would be underlined by Abdelmakar, the would-be bomber of Northwest Airlines, and the radicalism that you have within Nigeria. Also, you see this just in the mere fact that for a long time, GSPC in particular had very little success recruiting within sub-Saharan Africa. But now AQIM, successor organization, is having considerable success in recruiting in sub-Saharan Africa, and basically among disenfranchised populations who take advantage of the criminal organization. So you have more Tuaregs, more Barabish, and more black Mauritanians beginning to join the organization. So what I am most concerned about when we take a look at AQIM is the fact that there are so many factors there that begin to make AQIM potentially a very worrisome criminal organization with an attachment to Al-Qaeda. What would those essential factors be that concern me so much? Number one, the ability to operate throughout the Sahara. When I left the Sahara in 2004, I was still traveling around the Sahara with my friends and the embassy in order to talk to the villages up there, Erawan, Ber, Boujbeya, about what their needs were, what kind of projects they wanted to do. And in the end, we put in about $500,000 worth of wells and schools. Nobody goes into that area anymore. It is too dangerous. It's north of the Niger River. This means AQIM essentially has become more effective in this area. And why is that? The kidnapping. It's a criminal franchise. Professor Filou mentioned that GSPC was involved in kidnapping and really started it when they kidnapped 32 European tourists, 15 of whom they brought down into northern Mali. But now when you see the kidnapping that's going on not by the Algerians, it's going on by the Tuaregs, it's going on by the Barabish, who find this a lucrative way to make money for themselves and then sell the hostages to AQIM. Secondly, and I thought Mike did a very nice job of this, is to bring out the worry about the drug trafficking. Drug trafficking is becoming a major business in the west coast of Africa. As has been pointed out, those old caravan routes that are used by GSPC and then AQIM are now used by the drug traffickers. So increasingly, you have the ability of AQIM not just to obtain money from hostages, but also to obtain money from drug trafficking. And finally, to go back to perhaps the most worrisome aspect of all of this is the fact of marginalized populations, whether marginalized in northern Nigeria or marginalized in northern Mali, Tuaregs, Barabish, or black Mauritanians, because they do provide the fuel to drive this organization, whether through drug trafficking, because that provides jobs, or whether through capturing hostages. Finally, I would just like to reemphasize the point that Ambassador Sanderson said. The United States government is working with the region across all issues that involve terrorism and all issues that involve development. But what North Africa has done successfully, which is addressing the issues of terrorism, whether in Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia, Mauritania, it is much harder for sub-Saharan countries to do. And that is fundamentally the issue that we begin to face. Not only because in sub-Sahara Africa, the Sahara, which is mostly in sub-Saharan Africa, is a huge ungoverned area. So that makes it just geographically extremely difficult. We're also dealing with law enforcement organizations, military organizations, and indeed institutions that are far weaker in this area. So what I would emphasize here is that as the threat grows, at least in terms of its criminality and ability to destabilize the region, we will have to increase our assistance and our help to these weaker governments. And that means at the same time, in order for this to be effective, North Africa itself must very much increase its outreach to the sub-Saharan countries, so that as a region, there's a coherent and complex and effective response to the AQIM threat. Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador Huddleston, for that overview. Our next speaker is Craig Whitlock, a staff reporter for the Washington Post. Craig has just returned to Washington, D.C. to cover the Pentagon. From May 2004 to December 2009, he served as the Washington Post bureau chief in Berlin, where he was covering North Africa, terrorism, and Europe for the Post. We've been trying to get Craig out here for about 2 years, I think, to speak and give us some of his insights on North Africa. So we're delighted that you're back in Washington and that you're here to share your insights with us. I think Craig was responsible for some of the best reporting in the U.S. media that came out of North Africa over the last couple of years and really explained the threat of extremism and the development of AQIM in North Africa. So, Craig, thank you.
Hi, and thanks very much. It's a real privilege to be here, and you're too kind in your introduction. Unlike some of these other folks who have spent a lot of time living in North Africa, I did not. I spent the past 6 years about living in Berlin, where it is quite cold and we're used to snow. But as my 9-year-old son is delighted to discover, as soon as we move back to Washington, they cancel school even before the first snowflake falls. He went 5 years in Berlin without having school canceled once, and I think he goes every third day or something in Montgomery County. So unfortunately, his dad works for a newspaper, which has to come out every day no matter what. So I haven't been able to enjoy it as much as he has. I'd like to talk a bit about Algeria again, getting back to a subject which the first panel was rightly focused on, but in particular on the national reconciliation and amnesty efforts that have gone on there really for the past 10 years. And I think in some ways it's an especially pertinent and instructive example given what the Afghan government and the U.S. government are trying to push in that country in terms of reconciliation and reintegration with Taliban, both commanders and foot soldiers, in hopes of trying to bring that conflict closer to an end. I would say that I think the comparisons, I don't want to go too far because it's a very different country with a very different history, but both have had a particularly bloody and difficult last couple of decades, and I think there are some lessons that can be learned and some things that Algeria has gone through that it would offer as lesson learned, as well as we would say in journalism, a very cautionary tale for what can go wrong or what does not work. First, a little background. As Chaim said, I caution that my remarks, I'm not someone who has lived in North Africa, unlike many of my colleagues here, but as a journalist, I did spend quite a bit of time there starting in 2004. The Post had the foresight to send me there on a number of trips, particularly to Morocco and Algeria, starting with the aftermath of the Casablanca bombing in 2003. This was something that was a bit new for our paper. I think when I went to Algeria, we had only had one other correspondent that had gone there in the previous 10 years. This was an area that really had gone ignored by the U.S. news media. I think it was, by extension, also not well understood by our readership. I think that's in large part our fault. Some of it was that Washington was preoccupied with what was going on in Afghanistan and Iraq and Israel and the Palestinian territories, and understandably so. But this was an area that we knew very little about, and we tried to change that in some small measure by going back and focusing not just on the expanding counterterrorism partnerships that were taking place between Washington and the capitals in the Maghreb, but also the social changes and what was going on there. In Europe, where I had lived for many years, people were much more familiar with life down there, both from a cultural perspective. There are many immigrants going back and forth. People traveled down there. But for Americans, this was really terra incognita to a large degree, at least for our news audience. But in going to Algeria in particular, let me go back a little bit further. I'm not a student of the Civil War, the Black Decade, the nightmarish decade of the 90s. But after that, there was a turning point with the election of President Bouteflika in 1999. This started a phase where there were a number of reconciliation efforts that have continued more or less to this day and could be expanded further in the near future from what we hear in Algiers. This has been a bumpy road for Algeria. How do you recover from a decade in which, an estimated 150,000 to 200,000 people were killed in a civil war and in an insurgency and in terrorism? How can when you go to Algiers, even today, you still see on people's faces, this is a population that's still deeply traumatized by what happened there. And they try and explain it to you, but at the same time, they say, but you can't understand. The rest of the world turned away from what happened here. You ignored us for many years, which in some cases, certainly in my newspaper's case, was true. It was very dangerous to go into that country. It was difficult to get visas. This was a conflict that was ignored in the United States to a large degree. So people there, how do you get past that? How do you reconcile? How do you bring people back into the fold? Even for the past 10 years, I think no one has said that the government in Algeria is in danger, serious danger of being displaced or overthrown by this ongoing Islamist movement. But it's an insurgency. It's a terrorist movement that has not been able to be displaced. It's continued. And how do you bring that to an end? And there have been efforts, as I mentioned, by President Bouteflika to try and move past that, not just using the security services and the military to try and eradicate it, but to try and bring a permanent end to this in some way. And there were two main amnesty programs that were approved in referenda by the Algerian people, both after Bouteflika was elected in his first term in 99 and then subsequently in 2004. In both cases, these amnesties were fairly similar in that there was a reconciliation amnesty offered to fighters with the GSPC or other affiliated groups as long as they laid down their arms. There were a few restrictions in place that people who had been involved in, I believe they call it large-scale massacres or bombings that involved civilians were excluded from this. People who were supposedly involved in international terrorism, although the definition was kind of fuzzy, were precluded, as well as people who were guilty of certain moral crimes like rape and things like this. They were excluded as well. But other people, you know, this was a fairly wide offer that was extended, and it's a little difficult getting precise figures, but Algerian human rights officials have recently said, as of last month, that over the previous 10 years, perhaps 7,000 people who had been affiliated with the GSPC, GIA, or other groups had taken up this reconciliation offer. That's quite a substantial number of people. Now, they haven't all been success stories. Some of them have gone back to the fold. But this has been the extent of the program, again, over the past 10 years. President Bouteflika, when he won his third term last year, he often hinted that he would perhaps extend another amnesty, a more general amnesty, for people who were accused of all sorts of crimes or violence against the state and civilians. This has not come to pass so far, but this is something that is continually talked about in Algeria, that, again, there might be another round of amnesties given. Now, Bouteflika has been in the middle of a real debate in Algeria over the past 10 years over these reconciliation programs. On one hand, you have the Islamists who have vowed for many years never to accept this. You had the GIA, I believe it was their slogan in the early 90s, was something effective, no reconciliation, no truce, no surrender. They weren't going to negotiate under any conditions. This was, as you know, a very hardcore, hard-bitten movement that embraced all sorts of violence that was incredibly bloody and brutal in Algeria, involving civilians, foreigners, members of the government, and particularly members of security services in the military. As a result, the civilian population in Algeria was not very keen, many of them, to offer reconciliation to these people. These were, you know, when you go to Algiers, people say, these are fanatics, these are dogs, these are not people we can bring back into the fold. Why should we offer them amnesty when they killed so many of our relatives? They should have to answer for it. There should be justice, not reconciliation, not amnesty. At the same time, you had many members of the military who were behind the scenes opposed to what Bouteflika was offering. I had a couple retired generals talk to me in 2005, 2006, 2007, who said, again, these are not people you can negotiate with. If we offer them amnesty, they will simply go back and cause more trouble. You have to hunt them down and kill them. It's the only way. Now, I don't know that this was a majority view, but it was certainly a significant view among many members of the Algerian military and security services. So this is something Bouteflika has had to balance out. On one hand, while there have been a number of, you know, several thousand people who have taken up the reconciliation amnesty offers over the past 10 years, there is also evidence that it has not panned out very well. Some statistics that I will throw back. You know, each time I go to Algeria over the past several years, I always hear from government officials that how much success they've had in eradicating the GSPC, AQIM, the Islamist movement, the Islamist fighters that are rebelling against the government. And they always say there's only 300 to 400 to 500 of them left. And then the next year they kill or arrest 300 or 400 or 500 of them. And then the next year there's always that many more or more left. You know, the number rarely seems to go down all the way. Now, some of that is true. These groups are able to continually recruit. As we heard from Professor Filiou, that Iraq was a terrific recruiting tool that no doubt fueled the ranks of the GSPC and AQIM and continues to this day. But the fact remains that these reconciliation programs, while they have brought a number of people back in the fold, you can argue that perhaps they've hit a wall. There's still this insurgency going on. There's still these terrorist groups. What more can be done? Why hasn't it worked? Why hasn't it gone to the end? Again, this has been going on for 10 years. I mean, if they're just talking about starting this in earnest in Afghanistan, you know, nobody is saying this is going to take 10 years, but will it? I don't know. That's a legitimate question to ask. What is the time frame for these kind of programs? How long realistically can they be expected to operate with effectiveness? And can they be expected to bring everyone back into the fold? Probably not. How many is good enough? I don't know. But these are again, legitimate questions that we can examine in Algeria and ask the same ones in Afghanistan as the Afghan government and the U.S. government and its NATO allies consider a way forward there and trying to bring Taliban and other insurgent fighters back into the fold there. I'd like to close with a couple of interviews I did. Just these are people who I remember very vividly in speaking with in Algeria, how they had been affected by these reconciliation programs. And I think their stories are instructive. One thing journalists have an advantage of when we go into different countries is we have the ability sometimes to talk to people that people in the government can't, whether it's U.S. government or even the Algerian government. We sometimes, in fact, when I was in Algeria, I had much better luck getting Islamists to talk to me than government officials. They were more accessible, and they liked to talk, and they liked to tell you what was going on. And but this was an illuminating thing. On my first trip to Algeria in 2006, I met Abdelhak Layada, who many of you know is the founder of the GIA. He was arrested. He was captured in 1993, I believe. He's in prison for many years. He was finally released, I believe, not long before I arrived, and as part of one of the reconciliation programs. Layada is, he's no shrinking violet. He was a leader of this incredibly bloody insurgency and civil war. He is someone who is very much religiously motivated. This is not a man who you would expect, given his history, to accept an amnesty from the Algerian government, but he did. And I was very interested to talk to him and find out what made you finally decide after all these years, when he had been sentenced to death, the sentence hadn't been carried out, but clearly the Algerian government had been trying to turn him over many years. What finally caused him to take this route? And he was very cautious, and I wish I could say that I got the full story out of him, but I don't think I did. There are certainly limits for Western journalists and Americans coming in. He wasn't going to open up with his true feelings about everything. But I think he, for whatever reason, he clearly felt he had made a deal. He knew the parameters and limits of what he could do and what he could not do and still be allowed to accept this amnesty. He had his freedom to an extent. He certainly was still being followed around by the security services. I think an important factor was that clearly his family was part of a deal and that there was some sort of agreement that his family would be allowed to pursue their lives and would not be under pressure from the security services. So I think that was a major factor. But in talking to him, it became clear that he still had a long-range vision. This was not a man who had forsworn everything he had done. He did not all of a sudden say that he was the biggest fan of the Algerian government. I think he's thinking in the long term, and I think this is still the case with many of the members of the GSBC, AQIM. These are not people who are willing to negotiate permanently with a secular government. They are still motivated primarily by religious ideology and concerns. There are some differences, some different factions. I would argue that some of the AQIM groups in the Sahel, as Ambassador Sanderson and Huddleston have talked about, there is a financial motivation there as well. But some of these other hardcore Islamist rebels are, I would say, first and foremost motivated by religious ideology. And I think sometimes that's something we forget, particularly in Afghanistan. We think if we throw some money at the Taliban, if we throw enough money at them, they'll all switch sides. And that may work for some of them. But for some of them, I think we forget just how much religion plays a role here. So Layada is someone who accepted the amnesty, and maybe that's as good as you can hope for with someone like that. At the same time, I'd like to bring up another person who I didn't meet, but was certainly written up about, one of the suicide bombers in December 2007 who attacked the UN and Algerian police command centers in Algiers. This was a very, I believe it was just the second suicide attack in some years in Algeria, and this was clearly influenced by Al-Qaeda Central and changing the tactics of GSPC and Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. The fact that they were able to strike in the heart of Algiers at such prominent targets really raised the stakes in what people had thought was a tailing off of this insurgency and brought it back international attention in a way that they hadn't had before. One of these bombers was a 32-year-old, I believe, who was from a poor suburb of Algiers. He had been given the reconciliation and amnesty the year before. He was one of about 2,500 fighters who had been in prison and were given amnesty by Bouteflika under the National Charter for Reconciliation. And yet here was somebody who went back. And why did he go back? And there were conflicting explanations for this, but his family said one reason was he was given amnesty, he was let out of prison, but there were, on one hand, there were the economic pressures. This was a poor family. He had no job. You know, there was no money forthcoming for these amnesty programs for most of the people who accepted it. This is, even though Algeria has a great deal of natural wealth and resources and hydrocarbon money coming in, unemployment is still very high, and people in his shoes, in some ways, still had no future, a very limited future. So his family, on one hand, gave this explanation that it was economic. You know, the government didn't help him out. Yes, they gave him amnesty, but they dropped the ball there. They didn't find ways to bring these people enough education or a trade or some reason to reintegrate into society. Yet other people who had known him said that, again, the religious motivation was still a very powerful factor. And the fact that the United States was in Iraq served as a very big rallying cry for people to say, look, you need to join our cause. You need to help us. It's your religious duty to do this. And I think that's a message that is thinning out and is not heard the same way it once was in the Maghreb, but it's still a very powerful one. And I think this is one that the government in Algiers, I think, still has perhaps a more difficult time dealing with than perhaps in Morocco, where King Mohammed, of course, is considered the commander of the faithful, and he claims direct lineage from the Prophet Muhammad. And so he has a religious legitimacy that he can bring to bear that in Algeria it's much more difficult having this secular government that's been in place. How do you reconcile with an insurgency, terrorist groups that are so hardline religiously motivated? I think that's still an open question and one that, again, will need to be applied in Afghanistan one way or another. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Craig. Our final speaker on this panel is Dr. Jeff Porter, Director of the Middle East and Africa Practice at the Eurasia Group. Jeff covers Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, and that final Maghrebi country, Mauritania. Jeff has spent years studying, should I say decades? Years. Let's stick with years. Years studying North Africa. He's lived in the region. He's studied in the region. He speaks Arabic, including North African dialects of Arabic, so I think he's very uniquely positioned to give us his insight on some of these issues. He just came back from Algeria just last week, and Jeff was supposed to fly down this morning, and he called me in the middle of yesterday's blizzard and said, I think I should come down tonight. And he did, and he's here, and we're delighted that you're with us. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Chaim. And I profited tremendously from this morning's comments and from my co-panelists. And I do want to say thanks a lot to Chaim and John Alterman for arranging this conference. As Chaim pointed out, next year I'll be going on 2 decades working on North Africa, and I kind of toiled away in my little corner. North Africa is not Africa. When I was a professor, it was hard to find a home either in the African Studies Department or the Middle East Studies Department, because North Africa is not the Middle East either. If you ask most North Africans, they would either be North Africans or they would want to be Europeans. And there's certainly a lot of immigration pressure that indicates that. Nonetheless, it's a real opportunity to come down and talk about something that I care an awful lot about, and I'm glad to see such a great turnout. The panel that I was asked to speak about or to speak on, it deals with radicalization, de-radicalization, and counter-radicalization. So I'm going to try and keep my comments focused on that. And at the root of radicalization, de-radicalization, and counter-radicalization is obviously an ideology. What we're talking about is a radical ideology, and then attempts to either convince people otherwise or preempt people from embracing that ideology. And that in most instances, and what we're talking about here in North Africa, is Salafi jihadi thought or Salafi jihadi ideology, which is related to or is an extreme interpretation or a violent interpretation of Salafi thought. For the most part in North Africa, when we talk about Salafi ideology, we're not really talking about Salafi jihadi ideology. It's only rarely appeared over the course of, Salafi ideology has been present in North Africa for over 150 years since the real emergence of political Salafi thought. But it only really, it only occasionally manifests itself as violent Salafi jihadi ideology. So when North African states talk about de-radicalization or counter-radicalization programs, they're not really talking about Salafi jihadi thought. As my co-panelist mentions, that for most states, there's nothing to talk about with Salafi jihadis. I mean, you just go out and kill them. That Salafi jihadi stuff is so far beyond the pale of a rational debate that states won't engage with it. Instead, what they do engage with is an attempt to deal with Salafi ideology as a way of preempting any transition into Salafi jihadi thought. So, throughout North Africa, I'm not going to talk much about Tunisia because, first of all, I don't know much about it. Secondly, there really hasn't historically been a terrorism problem there. And thirdly, there's such a tight media environment, it's awfully difficult to find anything out about the country. So I'll restrict my comments mostly to Morocco, Algeria, and Libya and draw examples from there. And when these three countries do engage in de-radicalization or counter-radicalization, the most common approach to all three is obviously repression. There are numerous instances, throughout the three states of when I was living in Morocco, somebody would start coming to university campus and he'd grown a beard and was starting to wear a jalaba, and he'd get picked up by the police and disappear for several days and come back clean shaven wearing a pair of jeans. The same thing happens in Algeria. It happened during the Décennie Noire, when kids would show up at the university campus in Bouzaria, and they'd have a jalaba on, start growing a beard, and they'd disappear and come back clean-shaven and properly dressed. And obviously Libya has a long track record of repression of political thought, both what we would consider liberal political thought, but also Salafi jihadi thought. And the message was clear from the states, namely that the embrace of Salafi jihadi thought was a road to jail and was a dead end. And so that was the most common approach to de-radicalization throughout North Africa was simply repression. We've spoken about the amnesty quite a bit. Both my two colleagues now have spoken about the amnesty, and Ambassador Sanderson also spoke about it in Algeria. Algeria did adopt this amnesty program. It's difficult to speak about it, the amnesty and reconciliation, in the context of a de-radicalization program. I tend to see it more as a decriminalization of Salafi jihadi thought and not so much a coherent attempt to reckon with the ideological underpinnings of Salafi jihadi thought. And my colleague spoke about the example of Layada. There's also the example of Hassan Khatab, two members of GSPC or GIA who have renounced violence, but they haven't done so because of a program initiated by the state. They've only done so out of their own personal volition or as Craig suggested, out of a longer-term strategy to avoid the repression of the state. We've also discussed the Libyan approach, which is probably the closest we get to what we conventionally view as a de-radicalization program, namely under the leadership of the Gaddafi Foundation for International Charities, run by Muammar Gaddafi's second son, Saif al-Islam. The engagement with members of the LIFG, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, to rewrite the definition of jihad. They've published a book, which is currently being translated by, I think, some of my colleagues up at the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point. And there's the jury's still out on the effectiveness of this approach, but nonetheless, this is probably the closest we get in North Africa to a real de-radicalization program, where you take members of a radical organization and then publicly have them disavow the fundamental tenets of that organization. Now, by and large, we don't have anything similar to what you have. That North Africa doesn't have any corollary to the de-radicalization programs that you have in Saudi Arabia, where members of Salafi jihadi groups or Salafi groups are picked up, detained, and quote-unquote re-educated and then sent back out into the street. It just it doesn't exist throughout North Africa. The closest analog you get is, like I said, the Libyan case. Now, this doesn't mean that the states don't want to de-radicalize. Morocco, Algeria, and Libya do want to be the arbiters of de-radicalization. We've mentioned that, you know, Mohammed VI in Morocco is Amir al-Mu'minin, the commander of the faithful, that he wants to portray himself as the arbiter of religious interpretation, that he wants to be the one who determines what is proper Islamic practice and what isn't. Now, Craig mentioned some of the differences between Morocco and Algeria, and I would agree with that. But nonetheless, Abdelaziz Bouteflika does want to portray himself as the father of the post-conflict nation and wants to portray himself as the one who brings reconciliation and reason and a moderate Islam back to Algeria. I was on a plane flying down to Algeria once from Paris, and I was sitting next to a guy who looked like a fundi. I mean, he had a beard, he had the jalaba. And he said to me, alhamdulillah, Bouteflika, jeb salam le jazair. Thank God, Bouteflika brought peace to Algeria. And this is how Bouteflika wants him to portray himself. And he will try and engage in these de-radicalization programs in order to do that. Now, there's some problems with the approaches that the states have taken so far. In the first case, repression. Repression is a very dangerous tool that states deal with. That doesn't mean they don't use it frequently. But repression of Islamic thought is a heavy-handed repression of Salafi jihadi thought has the high likelihood of serious blowback. And instead of actually de-radicalizing people, it just forces people, committed radicals, out of the purview of the state or out of the sight of the state. So states are wary of the heavy-handed approach to de-radicalization. The national amnesty program in Morocco, in Algeria, has been derided. It was said l'amnistie nationale has been called l'amnésie nationale, the national amnesia. That instead of actually dealing with the fundamental ideological issues that underpinned both the Salafist group for preaching and combat and now AQIM, it's simply just forgotten those issues. And it said, okay, we're going to, 7,000 people, 2,000 people are now out of prison, and the population is very skeptical about the benefits of that approach. And then lastly, the Libyan approach of the engagement in the scriptural debate, taking on the fundamental issues of, well, what is jihad and what is the proper context in which to wage jihad? The jury's still out. My sense is, though, that the committed jihadis will largely reject the reinterpretation of jihad being promulgated by the state, largely because they will say, who are these people who have capitulated to the state to dictate to me what is the proper context of jihad? I'm a hardcore Salafi jihadi, and these people have now become the tools of Saif al-Islam al-Qaddafi, who incidentally has appeared on the cover of GQ, which really undermines his credibility. With clothes? Yeah, very nice clothes. Now, so there's been limited approach on the de-radicalization front. I think there's been more activity on the counter-radicalization front. In this case, I'll primarily talk about Morocco and Algeria, which are the cases that I know best. One of the things that Morocco and Algeria have both tried to do is to proactively prevent the emergence of Salafi Islam, as they understand that Salafi Islam is a precursor to Salafi jihadi Islam, which then becomes a route towards radicalization, violence, and terrorism. So they've engaged in an attempt to control the interpretation of Islam that is disseminated in their state. And they've primarily done this in two ways. The first one was the subject of my dissertation, so I could talk for hours about this. I won't. And the second approach was the promotion of an alternative interpretation of Islam that runs counter to Salafi jihadi thought. In the first instance, states have tried to control education. They've tried to control the production of religious scholars, of ulama. In a lot of instances, that means that the state imposes a curriculum in the Islamic studies departments at the universities, and that they hope that the members of the graduates of those universities, then when they enter into the field of religious production, promote a form of Islam that is favorable to the state. Now, if you drive from the airport in Algiers down to downtown Algiers, you pass, If you're heading into town, it's on your left. There is a beautiful establishment, a brand-new building up on the hill overlooking the ocean, which is the Islamic Law College. And the facilities there are much nicer than the facilities that you'll find at Bouzaria or any other academic institution in Algiers. And there's a clear message being sent that the state wants to promote Islamic education as a way of controlling the discourse. Now, generally, this proves infeasible, that when you educate people, they do what they want with their educations, and they don't instantly become tools of the state. So this has led to another approach, which is also common, and it's most common in Morocco, which is to flood the educational environment. When I was doing my dissertation, I enrolled in three different Islamic education programs in Morocco. I was at the Kulliyat Sharia, the Islamic Law College, studying Usul Fiqh, the fundamentals of jurisprudence. I was also in the Islamic Studies Department at the Secular University, and then I also took classes at the Qarawi Mosque, the madrasa down, the mosque itself, but I met students in the madrasas associated with the mosque. And what the Moroccans were trying to do is, by legitimizing any approach, they in effect delegitimized every approach to Islam. So you had ulama competing with one another, and none of them were competing with the state. The first lecture that I attended at the Islamic Law College, the professor, who was the dean of the university, said, "We're going to teach everybody, from a Tabari, who's a 10th century scholar, to Sayyid Qutb, who was killed in 1964 by the Egyptian state." And the idea was that you give these students everything, and none of them is, in essence, legitimate. The last comment, the last approach to counter-radicalization is a briefer one. Both Morocco and Algeria have openly embraced the promotion of Sufi orders as a way of countering the preponderance of Salafi thought. In Morocco, King Mohammed VI, with his Minister of Islamic Affairs, Ahmed Tawfiq, has embraced the Bushi Shia order, which is based in Oujda. And the Bushi Shia are antithetical to Salafi thought. And it's a very popular approach to Islam. Similarly, in Algeria, Abdelaziz Bouteflika is openly a supporter of the Tijani. He has meetings with his sheikh. His sheikh provides him with insights about his own inner jihad, but his own political affairs as well. If you go down to Taman Rasset, again, it's sort of architecture as evidence of the inclinations of the state. Down in Taman Rasset, in addition to a brand new mosque on the highest point in town, there is also a brand new building dedicated to the promotion of the Zawiyas, the Sufi brotherhoods in the desert. And this approach extends further south as well. I mean, if you go down to Kano in northern Nigeria, there's a decades-old conflict between the Sufi approach and the Salafi approach to Islam. You find it throughout Mauritania, Niger, and Mali as well. There are problems with this approach, of course. Controlling education is, I think, nearly impossible. Flooding the educational field is very dangerous. It's a very risky approach to trying to curtail radicalization. Sufi orders, the promotion of Sufi orders by the state, again, it's a difficult approach because people see Sufi orders as a way of social and political mobility, not necessarily as an open expression of religious observance. Now, my last comments. How does this bear on AQIM, which is presumably the reason why we're here? Well, in answer to that, it depends on how you view AQIM. On the one hand, we can view it as a hardcore Salafi jihadi organization that's primary motivation is an ideological one. On the other hand, we can see it as fundamentally a criminal organization with a veneer of ideology. And I think these are both to a certain extent true. If we think about the AQIM in the north, in the Tizi Ouzou, Boumerdès, Bouira region, led by Drouktal, I think that unequivocally that is a Salafi jihadi group, right? But as my colleagues have mentioned, we're dealing with a group of maybe 300 to 500 fighters. Now, obviously, there's some replacement going on as fighters get killed, more do join the group. But nonetheless, we're dealing with a fairly small group. I think you could also refer to Abu Zaid's group down in the south, in the Sahara, under the leadership of Jouadi, as a genuinely Salafi jihadi group that's committed to the tenets of Al-Qaeda and of waging jihad against foreigners. But on the other hand, if you look at Bil Mukhtar's group, Mukhtar Bil Mukhtar, has identified Professor Filou as being in the west of the Sahara, it tends to have more the characteristics of a simply criminal group. And the evidence of that is that when people do get kidnapped by Boulmokhtar, they generally get released. Whereas if you get captured by Abu Zaid, you generally get killed, which would have them more of an indication of commitment to Salafi jihadi thought. So, you know, given their sizes, that AQIM under Drukdel or AQIM under Abu Zaid, who has maybe 80 fighters alongside of him, and then given Boulmokhtar's questionable commitment to Salafi jihadi thought, do these groups, these three different groups, justify complex de-radicalization or counter-radicalization campaigns to be undertaken by the states in North Africa? Or does this simply become a criminal or a policing activity? Can you deal with do 300 fighters in the Boumerdis region justify the state to engage in some sort of convoluted counter-radicalization approach? Or do you simply leave it to the Tunsi and the head of the gendarmerie to reckon with a group of this size? Now, I think we have a tendency to get swayed by the context, a predominantly Muslim state, and we get swayed by the AQ in front of AQIM. But were this a group of 300 armed fighters, say, in the Basque Country, or in Northern Ireland, or in Idaho, or the FARC, for example, would we be talking about counter-radicalization and engaging the ideology of the group and a way of dissuading them from thinking the things they do? Or will we simply be dealing with it as a policing action? And so I'm not sure what the answer is. That's outside my purview, but that's a question I'd like to leave with you. Thank you.
Thank you to all of our panelists. You've given us a lot of material to think about. We have about 12 to 15 minutes for questions before we break for lunch. I'm going to remind you of John Alterman's rules of engagement for asking questions. Please ask one question, make sure it's a brief question, and ask your question in the form of a question, not a statement followed by what do you think. So I'll open up questions now for our panelists, starting in the back there.
Yes, hi. I'm Greg Aftandili, an independent consultant. My question is for Jeff Porter on the counter-radicalization effort. I was wondering if the socioeconomic aspects of counter-radicalization came up perhaps in your discussion with some of the officials. I know there's an academic debate whether economic deprivation or high unemployment or underemployment does lead to radicalization, but does that figure in terms of the strategies of the governments of North Africa? Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Certainly. I mean, it's difficult. Both in the Moroccan context and in the Algerian context, the governments have embraced this notion that social and economic marginalization fuels radicalization, and as a consequence, they've embraced approaches that try and rectify the economic disparities that you find in Morocco and perhaps to an even greater extent in Algeria. So they've certainly taken this to heart. But you know, this is going to sound actually radical in and of itself, but I'm not terribly convinced that AQIM is a tremendous problem in North Africa. And it's certainly a disconcerting issue. But I think that the governments in Rabat, Algiers, have largely dealt with the overwhelming support that Salafi jihadi thought might have had. And I think they rightfully recognize that most Algerians are not interested in becoming jihadis. Most Moroccans are not interested in becoming jihadis. They recognize that there are other problems that are much more urgent, namely just generalized social unrest, labor unrest, dissatisfaction with the ability of the government to supply basic needs. And so I don't see – they're trying to address the broader issues of educational opportunities and economic opportunities, but they're not doing so necessarily in a CT framework or counterterrorism framework.
Jean Abinader, the Moroccan American Center. Jeff, I think I fall on your side of the issue with that. When you look at the numbers of people who are actually involved in terrorism throughout North Africa, and when you look at what solutions are, you begin with, as everyone said from Secretary Sanderson on, you start with the economic and social development issues which run through the area of the lack of opportunities. The second one, though, I think, which is tied into this, which is probably more tied into the radicalism than not, is the whole issue of identity politics. I mean, the conflict in Algeria started as identity politics, not as an ideological, religious civil war. And I think that, and it's the same in Morocco, where you have the Western Sahara and the identity issues there. I mean, we talk about Islamic radicalism in North Africa, but it is not the most significant in terms of numbers and issues. It's a way to draw our attention to it, because we look at Somalia and we look at the Sahel and say, oh, look, it's creeping across. But the real issue is more the identity politics within each of those countries and those transnational issues like the Western Sahara. So where can U.S. policy in terms of de-radicalization, other than pouring money into economic and social development programs, if these are actually solutions that the local leaders have to address, the countries themselves, how do we get to those identity politic issues, whether it's the Western Sahara or the Tuaregs or the other issues that are the lack of integration that make the areas in the south ungovernable and make the urban areas difficult to manage as well?
I don't know. I think part of the solution is to let the let the governments in Tripoli and in Algiers and Rabat take the lead on their own domestic issues. This is especially the case in Algeria, where Algiers is extremely sensitive to what might be perceived as the U.S. engaging in domestic issues, even when the U.S. isn't, in fact, engaging. It's less the case with Morocco, where I think Morocco and the U.S. have a more collaborative relationship. But the other dimension of this may be to encourage the governments in Tripoli and Rabat and Algiers to foster an environment that is supportive of civil society more broadly, where even if the aspirations of different groups in those countries are not met, at least they're given an arena for articulation. Part of the frustration, I think, in Algiers, particularly dealing with the Kabyle, is that there is really no forum for the expression of Kabyle autonomy. In Morocco, I think the Western Saharans feel as if they've been marginalized from the public debate. The Berber question is no longer so much a question in Morocco, because the government has dealt with it very effectively and, in fact, embraced the Berber population. And Tripoli is a much more homogenous, or Libya is a much more homogenous population, so I think it's less of an issue there. But I think the most important step that the U.S. could take is through the creation of some sort of, or the encouragement of the creation of civil society, but ultimately leaving the legislative and policy agenda to the governments themselves.
Ambassador Helmsen, did you want to address that?
I was tempted just to tell you a story about being up in Arawan in the far north of Mali and speaking with a group of village elders, and the chief of the village of Arawan said, you know, we have been in charge of this area. We were talking at the time about ALPAR and GSPC and their activities up there. And in particular, they had received a fairly substantial ransom for release of the 15 hostages. And he said that this had led them to be more successful in buying weapons and to some degree in recruiting in the area, and that their sons and their daughters in the area very much needed some kind of hope and potential, because in these little towns up there, there's not even a clinic. There's absolutely nothing. One well that's used by the caravans as well as by the people for drinking water, so it's extremely poor. He said, but we have been running these trading routes up here and in charge of this land, this Sahara, for 1,000 years. So there will not be a success by the United States government or the Malian government or Algeria or any other government unless you deal with us, because we ultimately will control the area. And, of course, he's absolutely right. And the question becomes, how do you make it possible so that these indigenous groups, your identity politics, can control the area and can make a living in a way in which is within the confines of the legitimacy of the state? And, of course, that comes back to development. But the other side, which makes me worry more about what's going on up there, is that as long as there is the ransom and the potential to recruit the young men in the Sahara or even in northern Nigeria or Mauritania, then you begin to have the possibility to continually rebuild that 300 or 500 or maybe that 1,000. And you also have the possibility then for the more radical side, the Abu Sa'id side, as opposed to the Belmukhtar side, who's been around for 20 years, you know, doing everything from cigarette to arms trading and now to association with al-Qaeda, how to prevent, as the movement gets richer and richer from drugs and hostages, from being able to carry out those terrorist activities within North Africa and Europe that the more radical side really wants to do. And therefore, I think there is a potential that we really do face a serious problem of sub-Saharan Africa feeding a reoccurrence of terrorism in North Africa and Europe.
Thank you. Craig, I have a question for you. You mentioned the question of how we can measure success. How can success be measured in terms of de-radicalization programs? And I want to push you a bit on that and ask you if you've thought of any benchmarks or any kind of metrics that can help us measure success or mark some kind of successes or evolution in these de-radicalization programs.
You know, that's a great question, Chaim, and I don't have any metrics to offer, but I think one critical factor in that would be, again, trying to, with the population at large, how do they feel about these sort of things? And you want to marginalize the terrorist groups or insurgent groups as much as you possibly can in the minds of the civilian population, and which do they, you know, do they immediately reject these groups in comparison with the government? You know, are they sympathetic to the groups at all? You know, we've talked about this issue of, you know, where do these terrorist recruits come from? Why are they motivated? Is it religion? Is it economics? You know, I'm one who does not think that economics and poverty is the primary factor in motivating people, but I think it can certainly be a secondary one. And if you have the governments not being seen as doing enough to alleviate poverty, give people jobs and housing, and this is certainly something that's very palpable, I think, in Algeria and also in Morocco to a lesser extent, but particularly in Algeria, people, you know, even people who are not sympathetic to the jihadis, there's still this anger and frustration that the government isn't doing more. Where is all this oil or gas money going? Why aren't we building more housing, more jobs, things like this? And, you know, these are the people you want to fight for their allegiance and to at least have them feel that, okay, they're completely unsympathetic to the jihadis. They feel that the government is at least trying. You know, that's where I think you reach the place you want to be. And, yes, maybe you won't get rid of the final 1 or 200 or 50 or 10, as we've seen in terrorist groups in Europe, but you want to get to that point where public sentiment has shifted clearly to one direction and is, you know, maybe they're not happy with everything the government does, but there isn't this anger about them that would then lead them to say, okay, I don't believe in the jihadis, but I understand why they would be pushed to do something like this. That, I think, is the tipping point.
Can I just make one last comment? Yeah, in regard to Ambassador Huddleston's comment about the financial incentives for AQIM in the Sahara, you know, historically the Tuareg population or the indigenous populations in the south of Algiers and northern Mali, northern Niger have been extremely hostile to the presence of Al Qaeda, if only because it brings CT with it, right? And then and CT cuts into the any illicit activities they might be engaged in, such as smuggling, but it also cuts into the meager tourism revenue that they were able to generate. And so historically, you know, the Tuareg in southern Algeria, northern Mali, northern Niger were hostile to AQIM's presence. What seems to have happened is that the revenue that AQIM can now offer the indigenous populations is so much far above and beyond what was generated by other illicit activities or by tourism that the environment is shifting towards a more accommodating environment. That the local populations seem to be willing to accept the presence of AQIM because there is some immediate pragmatic financial benefit for them, which is greater than any financial benefit that it had been afforded to them by illicit activities such as smuggling or human trafficking and tourism. And I think that there was a missed opportunity, and now it's going to be an uphill struggle to replace the revenue generated by KNR. So I just wanted to respond to your comment. I think it's spot on. Thank you.
And we'll give Ambassador Huddleston the last word.
Well, trying to think of an appropriate last word, I'd like to go back to the relationship between the North African countries and the sub-Saharan African countries. I feel like I'm in a rather fortunate position because at defense we have all of Africa with just a little bit of Egypt excluded. But at state you have that line running between North Africa and sub-Saharan Africa, and I think sometimes that makes it hard for us to look at the regions as a whole. And myself, having come from state, it's a learning experience, first of all, to be looking at North Africa through the eyes of a sub-Saharan Africa person. And where I see the nexus in all this, of course, is the problem of terrorism, criminality, and how sub-Saharan Africa is dealing with this and how North Africa is dealing with this. And I can't help but think that sub-Saharan Africa, Mauritania, Mali, Niger in particular, are very much in need of some of the things I've learned about today from listening to the panelists here with me as well as the panelists in the first group. There's a lot more experience in North Africa about de-radicalization, about prison reform, about law enforcement, about the use of military, about the balance between the two that could be put to great use in sub-Saharan Africa. And it can best be done by the region and by the North Africans themselves working with their colleagues in sub-Saharan Africa. That's not to say that I don't know, that I'm not aware of the fact that you're already working on this, but I believe that's very important to work harder on this as a region of both sub-Saharan Africa and North Africa.
Thank you. This has been a very rich discussion. I hope you found it as interesting and fascinating as I have, and I want to thank all of our speakers for sharing their insight with us and for joining us today. Thank you to all of you. And we'll break for lunch now. We'll have about 20 minutes. Please help yourselves to lunch in the back. Sit down. And at 12:30, we'll have Ambassador Robert Godek joining us for the keynote address. Thank you.